Ambassador Swanee Ham, thank you for being with us and for speaking to the Global Observatory. You served as the U.S. ambassador to Austria during the time of the Bosnian War. And in your recent book, Worlds Apart, Bosnian Lessons for Global Security, you distill six main lessons from your Bosnian experience on conflict and international intervention. Could you tell us a little bit more about these lessons and how they're relevant today?
Sure. I took my experiences in the war and actually was writing articles for myself, little bits for my own journal. And when I came back and laid them all out, I was thinking, well, this will be great. You know, I'll string them together and they'll make a cohesive story. And only when I strung them out did I see that they didn't fit. That half of them that were about what I was doing at the policy table was almost completely inconsistent with what I was hearing from people on the ground, what was going on. And so out of that came this questioning that I had about how did this happen and what do we do about it? Because I think that we had some very wrong-headed policies because of that gulf. And so as I thought about these over literally several years, what I realize is that we have a very basic problem when we accept a great idea like the Clash of Civilizations, which is probably the most misguided idea in the last half century. Because if, in fact, you start out by viewing the world as a clash of civilizations, it becomes self-fulfilling. And one of the things that Dr. Huntington urged us to do was to figure out which side of the fault line we were on, and then defend ourselves against the other side. And you know, that's a disaster for the world, and we will be paying for that for a very long time. So the first lesson is to just test the truisms. There are a lot of truisms that are actually right, like you know, the idea of sometimes you have to intervene with hard power and sometimes soft power. That I think is very accurate. But we really do need to test those out and find out what they're based on and if they're based on any biases that we have. In the same way, similarly, but in a finer tooth, if you will, we need to question the stereotypes we walk around with. And for example, in Bosnia, there were distinct stereotypes about what it was like to be a Bosnian Muslim, what it was like to or what it was like even to be a Bosnian. You know, those people are always fighting, for example. Well, the last time they'd been fighting, the French and the Germans had been fighting. And no one assumed that the French and Germans would always be fighting. And so, you know, what is that about? What all is inside of that stereotype? It's important to unpack those. Another lesson that I drew is that you have to appreciate the domestic politics, and you have to really get into it. And if we had, we would have understood that, in fact, people had been living together. They had 35% mixed marriages in the cities. How can that be if the stereotype is that they've always been fighting? So that the domestic politics, understanding that, and the domestic situation, domestic dynamics, would have informed us in terms of the stereotypes, in terms of the truisms, you know, going up the chain. And similarly, to find the unlikely allies. If we had understood the domestic dynamics, we could have gone in and said, who are we missing here? And who we were missing was the group of a combination of 40 different women's associations that had formed across this tiny country of 4 million people. So that's a lot of organizations. And they were all women committed to stopping the war. And they were working as hard as they could. And we didn't have them reporting in any way in what we were doing. The U.S. Embassy didn't know about them. They weren't invited into the negotiations I hosted. I didn't make sure they were there. They weren't at Dayton. And they had a very different view that they would have brought. The last couple of lessons that I draw are, you know, really, truly, we have to find fault. There was all of this business about well, you know, we have to be even-handed here, you know, we have to be neutral, and forgetting that neutrality in the face of evil is complicity. And we had some serious evil going on. We had 90% of the human rights atrocities being committed by the Serbs. And these are Serb troops. I'm not talking about the Serb people as a whole, but it was terribly one-sided. And to say that we were being even-handed by treating different groups equally is really wrong-headed. To be even-handed, we would have said, to be truly even-handed, we would have said, all right, anyone who is committing these egregious acts, anyone, we're going to treat them evenly. And we would have had 90% of our effort going into apprehending Serb alleged war criminals. That would have been even, to spend 90% of our effort toward the 90% who were committing the crimes. And the last is to really embrace responsibility. And that was the point of intervening earlier. Wes Clark and I just did an op-ed, and he talks about the failure of NATO. And as you know, he became afterwards the Supreme Allied Commander of NATO, the failure of NATO to intervene. I was really close to that. I was meeting with two different Supreme Allied Commanders before Wes, and they were saying things like, well, you know, it's a political decision. I'm waiting for the green light from the Oval Office, et cetera. But they were not doing anything, as far as I could tell, to make sure that the information that was going to the National Security Advisor, who was then bringing that information to the president, that it was accurate. And I saw what was being sent over from the CIA, from the Department of Defense, and it was so off compared to what I was hearing from people on the ground.
When you arrived in Vienna in 1993, the siege of Sarajevo had begun in 1992 in April. Could you tell us a little bit more about the political debate at that stage when you arrived? What was the political debate in terms of responses to the siege and to the violence that was erupting?
I heard very, very little about intervention. I heard almost nothing, frankly. There was much ado about whether or not, I arrived in October, and the big question was whether or not the people of Sarajevo would have to go through a second winter. And they, in fact, went through a third winter and a fourth winter. And so nobody had any sense that this would go on so long. The people in Sarajevo who were completely unprepared for the blockades that went up and then the shelling that started them and the snipers, they did not see this coming at all. It was just sudden. It was like the World Trade Tower. It's just sudden like that. And they ran down to their cellars. And what they described to me, and I mean hundreds of interviews that I've done, they were virtually unanimous in saying, we had no idea who was doing this. We couldn't believe these were our, we knew these boys, we knew these men. We didn't know if it was a day or if it would be a week. That's the kind of thinking they were doing. Could this go on for a whole week? And that's part of the torture of it, by the way. I've had friends who've been in solitary confinement tell me that it's one thing to know you've been sentenced to 2 weeks in solitary confinement. It's something else to be put into solitary confinement with no sentence of time. And you don't know if it's going to be years or hours. And there was that quality to this.
In your book, you alternate between the outside views, those of the foreign policymakers deciding on whether or not to intervene, and the inside views that you were just describing of those living the daily lives of war. And you focus on the disconnect between these two constituencies. How can we bridge that divide in our foreign policy?
I think the most important thing we could do in our foreign policy is to create more of a sense of humility. Because with humility comes openness to learn. And we walk around as if we have answers that we do not have. And I think it's partly because foreign policy is so horribly imprecise. You know, we make decisions all the time that maybe, you know, 52% right, 48% wrong, and nobody knows which is the 52 and which is the 48, and all we know is that there's going to be hell to pay, and so I think that we often take on this stance of we know what the answer is. Maybe it's to keep morale up. You know, I can understand that in leadership. We're kind of caught there. But part of what happens then is we don't question ourselves, I think, deeply enough. And if we did, we would be looking for new voices much more. We would be saying, how do we bring in not just three or four new people around the table? How do we get 300 and 400 voices from civil society and put the energy into hearing from them and distilling their wisdom?
And coming back to those voices, you spent a large part of your career working to advance the role of women in peace process and peace building and mediation and conflict prevention. Could you share some of your insights on working with women in Bosnia and how they contributed to or not the peace?
Yeah, well, you know, when we talk about women, we're never talking about every woman. We're never talking about every man when we talk about men. But it was my experience in Bosnia that really launched me in looking at the role of women in conflict around the world. Now, I don't work on women as victims. I don't work on the sexual atrocities that happen to women. I don't work on how they get displaced, etc. What I work on is how you take their perspectives and their experience as survivors, yes, but also as attorneys, human rights experts, as physicians, as politicians, as very trusted leaders in their community. They may be illiterate, in fact, in a country like Afghanistan or Liberia or Sudan, where I just came back from South Sudan, where I'm working. So it's not about how polished they are as much as the leadership skills and abilities they have. And when you put a significant number of those women around the table with the men, I'll tell you, you get a different conversation. I was talking to some women from Afghanistan, and actually a senator was talking with them, Barbara Boxer, and saying, so what should we do about the Taliban? And they said, well, the Taliban must be included in the talks about reintegration and about the future of Afghanistan. And Barbara Boxer said, well, but you know that they, if they have power, you know, you will be oppressed and suppressed. And this woman said, with all due respect, Senator, you put us next to those boys for 3 days, and they're going to be talking differently. And I actually believe her. I was talking to another friend of mine who organized the Union of Soldiers' Mothers, Committees of Soldiers' Mothers in Russia. And I said, Ida, you know, she's about 5 feet tall, how do you get these mothers to go into the barracks and pull their 18-year-olds out so they won't be fodder for the fights in Chechnya? I mean, how do you go up against these generals, these Russian generals? And she said, every general has a mother. You know, and there really is that different perspective that the women bring.
Speaking of that different perspective, in one of your earlier books from 2004, This Was Not Our War, you interviewed Bosnian women and you shared their accounts, and most of these women rejected the idea that it was an age-old ethnic hatred that made the war inevitable. Do you suggest that the Western democracies misread the root causes of the Bosnian conflict?
Well, I would never talk about the Western democracies as if they are monolithic. But the ones who did think that this was inevitable, they were misreading it. And the women gave the most interesting clues. First of all, they said it very blatantly, but then they gave these clues without even realizing it sometimes. Like, one obvious is a woman who said, well, you know, we always, when we had our Easter, I made a point of never fixing any pork. And I said, why? I mean, we always have ham, you know, at our Easter. And she said, well, I mean, no, I would want to have something my Muslim friends could eat. And I thought, well, what are your Muslim friends doing at your Easter? You know, she said, oh, well, you know, they would come to, you know, we would always celebrate each other's holidays. Well, my first thought was, boy, you like to celebrate holidays, because that's a lot of holidays, you know, times four when you add the Jewish community. But that's the kind of thing you can't manufacture. But the other one, which I found the most amusing, it took me a while to figure this one out. I had chosen a woman. I was trying to get a really balanced group in terms of, I was falling into this whole thing. Okay, I've got to have these different women from different ethnicities. I've got to have atheists. I've got to have mixed marriages, you know, et cetera. And even choosing that method, which I thought was necessary for the book, I realized I was, if you will, succumbing to some of the outsiders' views about how there are these different ethnicities. However, one of the women, as I was talking with her, name is Biljana, which is a very Serb name, and so therefore I knew she was Serb. As she was talking, I kept getting confused, because she would describe her grandfather's home and how people would sit along the wall and etc. And I thought, what are people sitting along the wall for in a Serb home? And finally I said to her, Biljana, aren't you Serb? And she said, oh no, we're Muslim. And I said, well, what are you doing with the Serb name? And she said, oh, well, my name was actually, I can't remember, you know, Amina, which is a very Muslim name. My name is actually Amina, but you know, my sister loved the name Biljana, and so she called me Biljana, so my mother changed my name. Now, I come from Dallas, Texas, and I don't know if I can explain to you the meaning of the name Jemima, but Jemima is a black name, and Jemima is the name that in the 40s would be a colored, we would call it a colored maid. Now, the possibility of a white family, where I come from, naming a daughter Jemima is less than zero. It is just not going to happen. And so I would think about that a lot. In the mixed marriages, the 35% mixed marriages, in Dallas, Texas, it was probably 22% black when I was growing up. And I never met a black person who didn't work in someone's home. I have to say that again. The city was 22% black, and I never met a black person except for a servant in one of our homes. And I'm talking about in the first 20 years of my life. So that's how different it was in Dallas from Sarajevo. So if we want to talk about which place is ripe for war because of divisions, it would be Dallas, Texas. Not Sarajevo.
And finally, you just returned from a visit to Bosnia and to the region. Could you share with us your views on how peace is progressing and how Bosnian society has moved forward as a whole with reconciliation and justice?
Sure. There's been a whole new generation born, and so the cafe life is thriving. The arts are as avant-garde and fun as they have been in the past before the war. I mean, this is a very wonderful progressive city, Sarajevo in particular, and hosted the Olympics because of the multiculturalism. That was 10 years before the war started. So you do have this generation coming up with a lot of bright lights, but the place is politically stymied because of the Dayton Agreement, which was terribly short-sighted, terribly. And it froze the country by in fact, it put them way back. It froze them politically by saying there will now be, instead of one president, there will be three presidents. You know, there will be three prime ministers. There will be three foreign ministers. There will be, we're going to divide the country in two, but we're not going to say it's divided in two. There are these two, we'll call them political entities, and each one of them will have a parliament, and there'll be a national parliament. This is a tiny country. This is a country of 4 million people, and we're going to name one half of the country the Republic of the Serbs, even though we actually want people who are Muslim or Croat who were driven out by the Serbs. We want them to go back, but we're going to call it the Republic of the Serbs, but we want you to go back to the place that you were driven out of by the Serbs and, you know, move your family back. Oh, and yes, it's true that the mayor is an alleged war criminal, but, you know, we'll get to that later. You know, so it was, there's just this ridiculousness in terms of what is left there politically. And it's going to be like that until there is a very significant change in the Constitution.
Ambassador Hahn, thank you so much.
Oh, we can't. No. You can never end like that. No. You have to end with hope.
So
here's the hope. Let's see. Let me find the hope. I mean, I'm a woman. I have to end with hope,
okay.
Right? Okay.
Wonderful.
So here's the hope. The hope is that inside of every person is an ability to learn and to be transformed. And we need to have solid, progressive, excited leadership. And it needs to be leadership with great moral authority from the community, which means a lot of maternal kind of influence. And if we get the right leadership with support from the international community to do that, to bring up the moderating voices, this country has just what it needs to move forward. I mean, it has all of, you know, the smarts. It has people with energy, and it has good natural resources and inventive people. So there's great hope for Bosnia.
Thank you, Ambassador Hunt.